This is the Ballpark Digest broadcaster chat. I'm Jesse Goldberg Strassler, joined by Mick Gillespie. Mick, how are you?
Well, I'm doing great. You know what? The season's halfway over, and it's been a really fun year. So, you know, no complaints from me.
A couple of things that I definitely wanted to talk about with you this week. And the very first thing is what I think is the number one story in baseball, which is the death of Tyler Skaggs. First, your initial thoughts when you heard.
Well, Skaggs played in the Southern League. He was with the Mobile Bay Bears. And in 2011, we played Mobile for the Southern League Championship. And if my memory's right, he pitched against us in the series. He was always one of the best pitchers in my time, you know, like, I always thought it was kind of unique and showed how good of a player he was in person, that he was drafted by the Angels, traded to Arizona. When he played us, it was Cubs in Arizona, double A in the championship in that season anyway. And then he got traded back to the Angels. So he went back to the team that that initially got him, you know, in the draft. And then he's been one of their, you know, one of their rock solid pitchers. When I heard it, you always do a double take. And I'll be honest, I've had that same fear of something happening to me in my hotel room and no one being there to help me, you know. And I guess there was an executive with the Rockies, I think it happened to. If my memory's right on that, but and he died in his hotel room, and I've just always thought, God, that would be a really bad place to have anything happen to you, because it's quiet, you know. Sometimes people don't really check on you, you know, and so just sad for the family and for him. We have some of our players that are on that team, you know, that guys that I know, Tommy La Stella and Justin Bour. And so, you know, you just hate it. I mean, and it's life, you know. We forget in baseball too, Jesse, and you know this, we are in our own universe, and it's a different world. You know, our world is, you know, who can hit a slider and how hard someone can, you know, throw a fastball. And then all of a sudden, you know, the reality of life hits you when something like this happens.
True that baseball really does try to, and does in a lot of ways, separate itself from life, because in order to give your fullest, you have to tunnel vision yourself. You have to forget everything on the periphery and simply give everything that you've got for, if you're the pitcher, making that, executing that pitch, the batter, seeing what you can do to combat it, and everybody else around. Meanwhile, we're up in the broadcast booth, laser focused on the game in between the white lines, and this takes you well beyond the white lines.
Yeah, yeah. What was your thought when it happened, when you heard about it?
I'd connected it in my mind to the passing of Daryl Kyle first, and then I started thinking about all of those different baseball players whom we have lost either during the season or during the off season. The accidents, like the car accident with Oscar Tavares, or the swimming accident with Victor Sanchez, or Nick Adenhart. Both of us are Marylanders. He was one of the finest high school pitchers to come out of the state of Maryland, and with Nick Adenhart, it was a car accident. So I just started thinking about all the baseball players who died during their career, who their careers did not have a chance to finish.
Yeah, I thought of Nick Adenhart, too. Honestly, that's the first person that I thought of, and how tragic that was, and ironically, the fact that he was an Angel. Yeah. It's just you kind of, you know, even Jose Fernandez, you know, you go back and you start thinking about players that were killed, right, you know, or died right in the middle of the season. And it really isn't that many. But I think that because it is during the season and, you know, they're in the prime of their life, you know, it really sticks with you and you remember it.
Did you mention it at all on the broadcast?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I talked about it. I talked about the Bay Bears team that he was on, and I thought about my friend Wayne Randazzo, who's with the Mets. He was the broadcaster of the Bay Bears at the time. I thought about them winning the championship and running in the Wayne, drenched in champagne and beer, in the concourse and congratulating him and genuinely feeling like, you know what, I wish we could have won, but I like Wayne a lot. You know, he's still one of my good friends, and just that I was happy for him that he got that experience, you know? And so this guy, you know, this guy was a winner, you know? And so, you know, and he's going to be missed, Skaggs. And then I thought about it from a baseball sense too. You know, it's hard to replace a starting pitcher in the middle of the season. I mean, it happens because guys get hurt, but the Angels really don't have that much pitching depth, you know, and they've been kind of a surprise team a little bit. You know, they've got a lot of pop in their lineup, you know, and they're a fun team to watch, and they got the best player in baseball too, you know? So, I mean, they're going to have to figure out, you know, how to replace him. And then, you know, but sometimes things like this happen and it brings everyone together, you know, because you forget about, you know, that it's a game and think about the things that you want to do individually and you work together as a team. I got some good examples of that too. So for the Angels, you know, I kind of hope that happens for their season, but 2011, you know, I cover Alabama football and there was this massive tornado, and I've talked about it before, that, you know, killed so many people, and it was right through Tuscaloosa. And the football players that were on the cover of Sports Illustrated, they went out. I was out there with them. We all volunteered. You know, we're in the middle of this, like, debris field and, you know, different places where we could help, you know. And the athletic department at Alabama was great about being part of helping the community, you know, and Nick Saban at the top of it. And that team went on to win the national championship, you know. But you could tell that there was just something that happened where they – you know, and it wasn't even that the football, it was just that team was special because there was something more important than themselves, you know. When the Boston, you know, the tragedy in Boston happened with the terrorist attack, you know, where they bombed the Boston Marathon, the Red Sox rallied around each other and it became bigger than them. And then they went on to win the World Series, and they did it for their city. I can still see Big Poppy standing up there with the microphone, you know, after, you know what I'm talking about, after it happened. And then
I know what you're
talking
about.
And then when they won, yeah, I don't want to repeat what he said. But, you know, so sometimes things like this happen, and then, you know, maybe you go home and you hug your kids a little tighter and your wife, and, you know, and you thank God that you're still there and you pray for their family and, you know, and all that. But, you know, I just, it's terrible, you know, and it's terrible anytime someone dies way too soon.
Brought it up in the top of the fifth inning yesterday because I thought this is a good portion of time that we're not into the end of the game where the dramatics of the on-field action are going to battle with this. And it's not at the very start of the game when I'm still getting into what is the story of this game going to be? How is this broadcast going to go? What are we trying to describe? Top of the fifth inning, there's no real distractions. I'll let you know what's going on the field, but this was a good point in time to say, let's talk about this. And the way that I went at it, just like you discussed and described Mobile, to my mind, I saw Tyler Skaggs as a Cedar Rapids Colonel, and then when he was traded to Arizona, I saw him as a South Bend Silverhawk. And he was just that lefty on the mound on the other side who was looking like a future major leaguer. And that you could lose a player on our team, on the other team, at the age of 28. He was drafted out of high school, out of Santa Monica, 40th overall. And there are degrees of separation in baseball, but it's not the 6 degrees of separation like Kevin Bacon. Everyone is separated by 1 or 2 degrees at most. Everybody knows everybody else. And when a baseball team isn't going well, that's when you've got the individuals. The old story of the Yankees taking 25 taxis to the ballpark. But in general, a baseball team is the family. And so everyone has lost that family member or that friend of a friend that really does send ripples right through the game.
Yeah, I mean, and you make a great point, too. You know, there is 1 degree of separation between us and anyone in the game. I really believe that. Even sometimes, you know, maybe two degrees of separation between us and some of the legends that played a long time ago. Best example of that is I'm in Chattanooga's press box. There was a scout that used to come to all of the games there, worked for Minnesota, even when they were the Washington Senators. And the guy's name was Cal Ermer. Press box is dedicated to him now. And Cal, you know, he had been in baseball forever. And he had played, you know, in Baltimore, where we're from. I think he played for City High School. You know, so the, you know about the City and Poly.
Oh, yeah.
Big rivalry in downtown. Well, he played for one of those two, and I think it was City. And he was the best player in the state of Maryland, you know, like back in the 40s. And so, you know, I was just curious one day, and we were talking. He ended up having dementia, and I think that's what eventually led to his passing. But at the time, he was still sharp in mind, and I said, Cal, how close did you come to meeting Babe Ruth? And he looked at me, and he took one step back, and he said, well, about that close. So he was like maybe 2 feet from me. I said, you got to be kidding me. He said, nope. He said, I was the American Legion Player of the Year. He said the World Series was in Brooklyn. He said I got invited there, and you know, when the Dodgers were playing, and Babe Ruth was one of the, you know, the people that was on the field when I got my award. And I thought, man, that's just incredible to think that here I am, you know, one degree away from the Bambino, right? And you don't think that way, or you know, this off season, our friend Doug Greenwald's father passed away. You know, Hank Greenwald, the longtime baseball broadcaster in San Francisco. Doug's a good friend of ours. We love Doug, and you know, and if you're in minor league radio, Doug finds a way for you to get to know him. You know, he's a unique guy, and I mean that in all great senses of the word, because you know, he's just a person that has grown on me over the years, you know, and I think a lot of Doug, you know, and I like Doug a lot, and I love Doug. I think he's great, you know. And one time I was doing Alabama basketball. We were in San Francisco. He finds out I'm there and invites me to Thanksgiving dinner because it was a Thanksgiving tournament. And so I took a bus to a train and a train in, you know, we were playing in St. Mary's. And end up at his house, and next thing I know, I'm there talking with his dad about baseball, and he's telling me stories about knowing Joe DiMaggio, and him being at bars with Joe DiMaggio and hanging out with Joe, and here's like 6 autographed baseballs of Joe DiMaggio, you know. So it's like, that's how this game works, you know. You just run across people who are one person away from anyone. I mean, anyone that knows Tommy Lasorda. I mean, think about all the people that he's met, you know, and I've met him on numerous occasions. So if you're around long enough and you get to know enough people, you know, the degrees of separation really are small. Now, I wonder, like, you know, if I'm one degree from Ty Cobb, you know, I've never really thought about that one, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I wonder if you named a player, like how quick you could figure out if you knew someone that knew him.
Well, the easiest way for me is when scouts come in, because I'm someone who will always sit at a scout's side and just get them telling stories. We had a scout come in who is a native Alabaman, and he was telling me a story yesterday about he played for Harry the Hat Walker. He was a UAB Blazer. Harry the Hat's brother is Dixie Walker, which started him talking about the movie 42, which started him talking about how Dixie told him that the biggest mistake that he ever made in his life, and he went into a perfect Dixie Walker impression, was the petition to stop Jackie Robinson from joining the Brooklyn Dodgers. And now he's telling me all about Dixie Walker 1940s Brooklyn Dodgers stories. I could have listened to it for a long while.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, and if you were in the Southern League and you ever went to Jacksonville when, you know, the Bragans owned the team, you know, maybe you run into Bobby Bragan. Obviously, it was Jimmy Bragan was Bobby's brother, used to be the the president of the Southern League, and then Pedro Bregan owned the team. His dad, Peter Bregan, owned the team, you know, and so, you know, think about that. I mean, like, you know, the Bobby's there. If you ever got a chance to meet him, you know, he was one of the guys that was not, didn't want to play for the Dodgers because of that. And then obviously, learned a very valuable lesson about humanity in his life. You know, he's a good example of, of how you can change your heart about, you know, maybe things that you were taught that aren't necessarily true. And that's 100% true. You know, you treat people the way you want to be treated, you know, but back then that's not the way that people were educated. And, and to think that in this day and age that, you know, you're that close to someone that was part of that, you know? But I mean, I guess, you know, that's kind of our story. I was talking to someone the other day about a guy named Carl Long, who was a center fielder in the Negro League. And we were just talking about baseball, and Carl was, played in the Negro League, and he lived in Kinston, North Carolina, and he would travel around and, you know, he basically just talk about the Negro League on the radio. So I had him on anytime he was in town. I like to talk about it. I like to hear his stories. And if you listen to my broadcast, I occasionally bring up the Negro League. And there's a lot of people that don't even know that there was a Negro League, that had no idea that there was that there was, because of segregation, you know, a black league and a white league, you know, pretty much. And Carl would come on and tell stories about what it was like and playing in places like Rickwood Field in Birmingham, which is where we have one game a year in the Southern League. But then you hear stories about guys, some of the great players of all time, which Satchel Paige, and you know, this is the one player, if I could go back in time, I'd want to watch. You know, I'd want to see Satch in his prime, you know, in one of his games, but to kind of hear about that. And then also baseball too. You know, Carl would always talk about playing shallow in center field. We have a guy in our league, Jose Siri, who plays very shallow, and I think he's an excellent defender. He takes a lot of those short hits away. And he said he did the same thing, you know, because he was fast and that was kind of just the style he played in. But, we're basically 1 degree from anybody that played in this game in the last century.
Whenever I hear about center fielder playing shallow, that's just speaker style. If you read back in the day, that's where the Gray Eagle would play. Let me transition. Mick, another key story this past week came from London, the London series, the two games between the Yankees and the Red Sox. And yes, one story was that the Yankees defeated the Red Sox in both games and scored a ton of runs. There were 30 total runs in the very first game. But another story was, and both of us are broadcasters, did you see any of the broadcast commentary? And namely, Darren Fletcher was the lead broadcaster for the British broadcast of the game, and all of the plaudits that were heaped upon him for his commentary of the two games.
Yeah, I did. Spencer Siegel, my partner, he's playing me the highlight of one of the home runs, and it was great. I loved it. I mean, I don't know that I'd want to listen to baseball broadcast it like that every day, but when the Cubs play, you know, the Cardinals and London next year, you know, it'd be fun to hear this guy, you know, and like it sounded like soccer and soccer terminology, used for a baseball game. I loved it. Look, when you see all of these people watching European soccer over here now and having a team and a vested interest. And I've noticed this trend, which, you know, I'm going to say for the last 4 years, maybe even a little before that, the interns that I have that help us out, they love soccer. They like talking about soccer. They like watching soccer. And it's not the soccer in our country. You know, they're not talking about the MLS. they're talking about the European teams. You know, they all have, and then Spence, you know, he'll sit there and explain what's going on, just to keep me updated, because if it's not World Cup, I'm going to tell you the truth, Jesse, I'm not really interested in it. I got enough time for me to cover baseball and college football, you know, and I think normally that takes up just about most of my brain space during the summer, you know, but Spence will sit over, and anything that's going on, he's got it on his computer, and he points it out to me. And so my point is, I hope that Major League Baseball can do the same thing and branch itself out into Europe, where there's people over there that maybe it's not their favorite sport, but it's a sport that they like to follow, and that they pick a team. And I hope that team's the Chicago Cubs.
Well, next year, there you go, Cubs Cardinals. But it was the original World Baseball Classic shirts that had the different languages or the different colors. But the phrase, "We speak baseball," whether it's in a British accent, whether it's in Japanese, whether it's in Spanish, we speak baseball, and that bring people together right around Earth.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, think about your life. You know, how important has the game been to you, you know, and the things that you do from the time that you were little until now? It's, you know, it's what you do for a career.
Raised on it. Exactly. So it was first my life, and now it's my living.
Right. Both. Which is like when the reality of like the end of the season comes and you think about like, okay, am I going to go back and do this again? And in the minor leagues, I mean, you know this, Jess. I mean, this is it can be a grind, you know?
Oh yes.
It can be a grind, and it's not easy. And I'll tell you what, and I think you feel the same way too. I feel like I've got the best job in the minors. And if I don't, it's pretty close to it. You know, I get treated so well. Our fans are great. You know, we've been on some great stations, and people care about the team. You know, it's not always like that. But at the end of the year, you're like, you know, am I going back for another one? You know, if you're not getting that opportunity at the major league level, right? Because you're like,
right,
you know, what am I wasting my life doing this, right? But then it's like, you know, you don't want to break up with this love that you have with baseball.
It's true. About the London series, here's what appealed to me that I wanted to bring up. I think one reason why a lot of the commentary was loved was, in addition to the accent, which always adds something, the language used, that a baseball was absolutely walloped. It struck me that baseball language, if you go back in the day, you go back to the turn of the century and of the 1900s, and then you see the way that the writing titans and then the broadcasting titans wrote about baseball, a Damon Runyon or Grantland Rice, the way that they wrote or the way that they talked was poetic, and that a lot of baseball language has been poetic, absolutely walloped. Well, baseballs get walloped. You know, it appeals to me, how do we talk about the game? And so, yes, there's the accent upon it, but this is the way that we have discussed baseball for an awful long time. It lends itself to poetic language. In soccer, one of my favorite things that a commentator can say overseas is they're asking questions of the defense. And that's simply meaning that an offense is threatening and they're seeing how good the other team's D is, and maybe there might be a goal coming. But the whole idea that it's phrased as asking questions. You and I have discussed what you prefer to use to discuss baseball, what I like to say to talk baseball. And it's the same thing. It's that English flair, which is very graceful, but baseball language is often described so gracefully.
Yeah, well, I loved it when on that home run by Gregorius, he's saying that he's talking about how box office he was.
Absolute box office.
I'm like, you know, I don't, like I said, I don't know if I'd want this every day, but when you're in, you know, in Britain, you know, you need a guy like that, you know, you're just screaming things that you would hear on the pitch, you know, but it was
But
great,
if you go
you know,
back,
was,
Mick, Carl Hubble, the great Giants Hall of Famer, was called the meal ticket. And the reason he was because him being on the mound meant that the Giants were selling tickets, which meant that everybody else was going to get some money to pay for their food. That he was everybody else's meal ticket because he was box office.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, you know, Gregorius, I think that, did you see where they sold 70% of the tickets were sold there and 30% were sold in America and people made the trips over?
Oh.
And I think that
Is there when the fans are all American?
Well, no. I said 70% were spent in, were bought in London, you know, and then 30% here. Well, the commissioner thought that was really a good sign because, you know, it was like people over there were interested in seeing a baseball game. And I thought that was good too. You know, I thought that was a good sign. I mean, you know that there's going to be a certain amount of Yankee and Red Sox fans that are going to jump on a plane and it's an excuse to go over there. Right. But,
like a destination trip.
Yeah, right. Like the Cubs have that Cubs destinations and stuff. Yeah. But, so I don't know. We'll see if it grows the game. You know, I certainly hope it does. The stadium didn't really look like a stadium. And I mean, like a baseball stadium. I mean, it's just weird how the ball was traveling, but it looked cool. You know, I mean, I saw that they scrapped the idea they were going to do some games in Asia next year to open the season, and then they got rid of them. But I think baseball is doing a good job of trying to branch out and into other markets.
I agree. Just in terms of putting the game out there and saying, come, watch, enjoy. Because to my mind, and there's a great Hannah Kaiser article that she just wrote for Yahoo all about why should fans come out to the ballpark? Does winning actually sell tickets? And can't you just enjoy it on the couch watching TV? And my disagreement is no. My disagreement is there's so much more that you have to process while being at the ballpark itself that you can't get from a TV broadcast.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's why being at the game still always going to beat watching the game. But hopefully listening to the game will be a part of people's lives too. Do you ever see radio going away?
I would say no, and I've been asked this a number of times before, because I feel that there's so many parts in people's lives where you can't use your eyes, whether you're driving in a car, whether you're riding, whether you're working, whatever it is, your eyes are occupied. You have to do something else, but your ears are not occupied, and because your ears aren't, the audio is necessary. That's where people have turned to podcasts or music, but that's where broadcasts come in. Because whatever it is that you're doing, you might still want to know what's going on with your team. And so because of that, I feel an audio broadcast of a live sporting event will always be around. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I've debated this back and forth. I mean, you know, I can remember when I was in college at Alabama, I was friends with the dean of the communication school, and I used to just go into his office and talk to him every once in a while. And I remember him talking to me about the future, and he said, what do you think the future is going to look like in broadcasting? You know, and this is before iPhones, you know, this is, you know, I'm that old, but I mean, it was a while ago. And right before that whole revolution kind of kicked off, and he said, well, what do you think about like streaming, you know, and internet wasn't really that big back then. You know, they weren't streaming baseball games or radio shows or anything. I'm talking about radio, not even TV. And then he kind of said, well, you know, from what I understand, the future is going to be where you can basically watch TV, you know, anywhere. And it was the first time I'd ever heard that, you know. So and over the years, you know, I work with Len Casper, and I really like to watch he and JD. I like to listen to Pat and Ron do on Cubs games. If the Cubs are on and I'm not working, you know, I want to be watching them, right? And so, or listening, you know, one way or the other. And I just remember the moment where I was like, you know what? I can watch this anywhere. You know, like I can put this game on and watch it on my phone anywhere. And then you know, and then I've been part of that. You know, I was one of the first people that was used on talent at the, you know, for Alabama on the SEC network. And remember going through those first like broadcasts and cutting my teeth, doing soccer, ironically, and then being able to just go back and watch it and archive it and everything else. So, you know, I think video is always going to have a big part because I feel like video is so much easier to access. Plus you can watch it, you know? And I mean, like, no matter how good someone is at describing something, you know, seeing it with your own two eyes is just going to be more natural, you know? And I mean, like Vin Scully's the best ever, you know, and I would rather listen to him than watch a game. Same thing with John Miller. I love, you know, just like you do, you know, I love John Miller and I enjoy listening to him so much and I don't need to watch the games. You know, but you know, you still have this, you know, this ability to look at something and process it differently than if you hear it. But I love radio, and maybe I'm kind of old school when it comes to that. I just enjoy it. And the other part about radio and why I think you're right is that I can be driving in my car. I can't watch the game, but I can listen to the game. You know, I can be working in my garage and cleaning, and I can listen to a game, but I couldn't watch it. You know, you can multitask with radio. It's different than television. What I feel like, and maybe this is kind of where we should, maybe a area we can get into, but I feel like the art of doing radio is starting to become a lost art, you know, the description. I feel like we have a lot of television type of broadcasters that get into radio because it's the way for them to get into the business. But that when you're listening to them call a game, and I'm talking major leagues and, you know, college and other places, that you can tell they grew up not listening to radio because they don't broadcast in a way that's descriptive enough for you to be able to enjoy the game.
That whole idea of painting the picture, that's not a cliche. And I completely agree with you. I will ask young broadcasters, hey, what's your dream job? Young radio broadcasters. And I say that because they are literally broadcasting games on the radio. And I say, what's your dream job? And it's always television. I think one of the biggest problems, Mick, is that they don't learn from listening to the radio. If you don't learn from listening to radio broadcasters doing the game, if you were processing the game by watching the game on TV or watching it via stream, but a television broadcast, you don't understand how important it is to get in front of the pitch. You don't understand how important it is to describe what occurred. One of the biggest problems that a young radio broadcaster can make, and this definitely happened to me, is if there's a diving play, it's not good enough to say, what a play, or wow. You actually have to say, he lays out to his right, or something of that sort that lets me understand what happened that he made the play. There was a great Harry Carey call when I was a kid that I just remember him saying, holy cow, let's go to the sixth. I still have no idea what happened. That's okay for Harry. That's not okay for a young broadcaster. And I think, as you say, that the whole point that it's becoming a lost art, if you're not learning from listening to the radio, if you're not learning from whatever might teach a broadcaster the best way to paint that picture, and you're not painting that picture, this is not carrying radio broadcasting forward.
Right. And there's a certain entertainment and personality that you also, with painting the picture and being descriptive, that all of the legendary broadcasters on radio had that I think is missing too. You know, the sense of humor, the broadcasting with a smile, you know, I think guys come and I'll have assistants every year. And from time to time, the guys who have been around longer, it always takes them longer to realize what I'm doing. You know, I think that they look at it and it's like, okay, you know, he might have messed this up, or this wasn't, you know, he could have done this better, you know, because we're all like that, right? You know, why did he do this? Why did he do that? And then at the end of the game, you know, and you worked with Jim Tocco, who I thought was brilliant in this area. People just got it. You know, you just walked out and they got him. They knew him because he was himself on the air and he did all the other stuff. He was descriptive and intelligent and all that. And I think there comes that point where it's like, you know, I'm not as worried about finding the perfect stat, a great example, as I am entertaining the people that are listening to our broadcast, right?
Mick, that's one of my biggest frustrations. I'll listen to a baseball game on the radio where there's nothing going on in the game, and so there's nothing going on in the broadcast. And I'm thinking, if there's nothing going on in the game, it's up to you, the broadcaster, to make me say, boy, I'm really enjoying listening.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, and you know, during the course of the game, you know, and I've actually, to be honest with you, you know, like I've had an internal debate too. Like, when do you turn off the stories and focus on the game? And in the minor leagues, it's so much different than in the big leagues, you know, because the biggest difference in this aspect is if it's a blowout game, you can get into a lot of the stories, like all of the things that we were talking about today, we could have easily worked into a minor league game. We know that the people who are listening to the game, for the most part, unless you're on internet and it's all just family members, but if you're on the radio and you're on a good station and the people actually out there listening, they don't care as much about the nuts and bolts play-by-play of the game as they do being entertained. And so you talk about other stuff in between the pitches in the game, you know, and it's like, for me, I'm trying to juggle three things at a time: the game, you know, whatever stories I got going on, sometimes a guest or who, you know, or Spence, my broadcast partner, and what he's saying. And then, you know, but there comes a point sometimes where the game gets really good and it's maybe it's close. What inning do you, you know, cut that off and kind of get into, you know, hey, look, and I call it the business end. You get to the eighth inning and it's a close game, stories are over and it's time to just really, then I'm going to do the stats. Then I'm going to really get into the other stuff, you know. But when it's, you know, 1 through 8, or 1 through 7, probably better, and I'm in the minor leagues, I know no one cares. So, I mean, like, I mean, I'm be honest. Like, they don't care. I mean, I'm trying to sell them on the guy that's at the plate. I want some background stories on him. I'm gonna hit, and this is just my personal style, and I honestly picked it up from Red Barber because I know it was something that he did every day, is I hit the news. But I don't hit – I only hit baseball news and maybe sports if it's an interesting story, something that happened, you know, and another sport that isn't necessarily about that sport, but just something crazy that we can get into. I like those kind of stories, you know, funny stuff. And I want people to be like, I don't want to get out of the car, or man, I just listened to a minor league game and it was great, you know. And I had a lot of people have said that over the years, you know, like just how they really don't care about the team, but they find themselves listening to the games, you know. And so anyway, going back to like, you know, having these broadcast partners that come in, you know, it's like they're stuck on stats, or you know, they want to maybe geek out a little bit too much. And it's like when you leave these minor league booths and you go to the big leagues, you know, you got to be cool, right? You just got to be cool.
Yeah.
Everyone up there's cool. I mean, like they're cool, you know. Like you go into the White Sox booth, right? And you got Steve Stone in there. Well, I mean, I grew up listening to him and Harry Carey. No one's ever been cooler than Harry Carey, okay? He's still cool. And then Steve, you know, is a Cy Young Award winner, and he's got great stories and awesome insight. And then you go in the radio booth, and Ed Farmer's a former player, and Darren Jackson's, like, a great guy, you know? And you're in there talking to him, and I mean, like, these are guys that you could just sit there and talk to all day and want to go out and have, you know, have a beer with or dinner with. You know, same thing with the Cubs booth, you know, Jim DeShays and Len and, you know, and then, you know, Pat and Ron Coomer. Ron Coomer, I mean, you know, he's like everybody's best friend, you know. You go through the league and, I mean, they're all like that. You know, like I get around Marty Brenneman and, you know, I like messing with Marty. You know, I know the topics that, you know, he's going to give you a good opinion on. And, you know, and then Cowboy in there, same way. So my point is, look, you go around the league and it's not a bunch of like, you know, nerdy guys. It's a bunch of really cool, like, dudes, right? And now some ladies, you know?
I will contradict you, but I'll also agree with you. Jason Benetti, to my mind, is very nerdy, but also very cool.
Yeah, I know him too. And I mean, like, he is a cool guy, though. I mean, like, you know, he's got the stat thing going on. But, I mean, when you're up there, like, he's got this dry, witty sense of humor. And I'll be honest, he's really grown on me. You know, I know him as a person. You know, I remember meeting him at Wrigley Field when he was still broadcasting games for Syracuse, you know, and had just signed a contract with ESPN, you know, and he had just been up there, and Len Casper and him and I were at the same table. I had no idea who the guy was. I didn't know him from Adam's house cat, you know, and, you know, we're talking and then next thing I know he's on ESPN. And then, you know, next thing I know he's doing the White Sox. But I don't think he's a nerdy guy, man. I think I really think that he's a fun dude, you know. And I'd heard John Lazor is a good buddy of mine, the Hokies broadcaster, and they were in the same minor league together in the Carolina League, and he'd always talk about one of the coolest dudes he knew, Jason Benetti. So I'm telling you, it's crazy how, you know, the perception, and I'm not saying it's every single person. I know there's some guys, and I'm not going to name them, where I'm like, okay, well, maybe not him, but the vast majority of those people are cool.
It's fascinating to me, and the way that you got started talking about this is the whole idea with stats. I think that if a broadcaster wants to use stats, that those stats have to be utilized the same way that a broadcaster uses words, which is be accurate and be clear. So if you're going to say, okay, this guy is standing in, I've got a good stat for that, what is the story that you're telling? What is it that you're trying to illustrate? The same way that you entertain with your stories, you can entertain with the stats. You can make somebody feel like they're smarter. If somebody listening in, this guy steps in, you're like, look, he's got a really low swinging strike percentage. He's going to hit with contact. And if the count goes to two strikes, you're going, you know what I just told you. This is not a player who strikes out very often. That makes the listener feel smarter the same way it does when you're going around telling the different news or describing what the weather is. It's everything that makes them feel like they are more connected to the game.
Yeah. But I mean, look, I'm so anti like having a stat for everything, you know. At the same time, I think there is the right time for it. You know, I don't think that you can eliminate the stats either. You know, I'll tell you what, for me personally, like if I have a partner who's really good with the stats and the numbers, it's a compliment to what I do. And I think that's part of what, you know, when you hear a great broadcast team, you know, on radio, that's part of it. You know, Marty Brenneman for years was with the old left-hander. And, you know, those two, like Marty was kind of the bad cop and Joe Nuxall was the good cop, and great, great radio, you know, great radio. I mean, it just worked, you know, and it's like, you know, why are Abbott and Costello funny still, you know, or Laurel and Hardy, you know, like, but broadcast teams are the same way when you kind of get that good mix, you know, because some people like a lot of numbers and want that too, you know, so it's, there is a balance.
What I try to do for every single player in each starting lineup is I'll write down a pertinent stat, and it can be as simple as 3 for his last 48. All right, we understand he's ice cold. Now I'll write down a pertinent personal story, something interesting about the guy off the field. And now I've got two different bullet points that I can refer to if I say, okay, there's space in this at-bat, there's space in the game for the listener to get to know a little bit more about the guy.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, how good are you at, like, the, you know, like when you work with someone, like timing, you know, kind of when to talk and when not to?
I get physical, Mick. If I want to talk, I will raise my hand. I will tap them on the shoulder. I will do anything I can because I do not trust that I can just talk and they'll talk and I'll talk and they'll talk. If we're really good at working together, then we can get that way. But I come from a family that has no troubles cutting each other off and interrupting. And on the radio, that doesn't sound so good. So I will get their attention if I have something that I want to add. How about you?
Well, I mean, I just try to balance it. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm in the middle of a conversation and I want to get that last word in, and, you know, and then I realize, like, you know what, I need to kind of back off, you know. And I know working with Len during spring training, you know, he's really good at interjecting, and you know, so I try to time it out. I want to pause a little bit for them before the pitch. Sometimes, you know, just you're in the middle of saying something and maybe you talk a little bit too fast, maybe you talk over one, but you're not trying to, you know. I know that we want to have it sound a certain way when we go back. But I still think that at the end of the day, if the person listening is entertained, that trumps anything else.
Let me put something forward. Let me say that there are actually three different broadcasters going at once that you don't want to interrupt on the air. And I'm going to say it's you, it's your broadcast partner, and then it's the crowd microphone, which needs its equal part. My broadcast partner is Adam Jaxa, and he reached out to the Washington Nationals broadcast crew. And he said, among other things, how in the world is your crowd microphone so good for the crack of the bat or the pound of the ball into the mitt? What he learned was their broadcast engineer, the on-site engineer, turns up the crowd microphone huge every time the pitch is about to arrive.
Yeah.
So that's what we've started doing. We get that microphone up hot just for that pitch arriving in for the crack and the pop into the mitt. And because of that now, we've got him talking, we've got space for me talking, and we've got space for the crack of the bat, we've got space for the pop in the mitt, we've got space for the crowd to chatter and hum. And I really think it's the three of those all complementing each other, and you're not trying to talk over the crowd. If the crowd gets loud, you should only be saying pertinent details. You really should not be talking over the crack of the bat or the pop in the mitt. You can say, here's the pitch, and then lay off, and then bang, or crack, and then it's clear, and then you can launch back in. But I really do think it's about the balance of those three.
Yeah, I think you're right, too. And we had one of our engineers that during Cubs games last spring that did that. And there's a term for it, too. You know, I'm trying to remember what the engineer's name that actually came up with that, you know, that concept. Turning up the mic for the pitches, but it sounds great. You know, if you have someone that can sit there and do that, you know, more power to you. You know, the problem is that, you know, we don't have an engineer that can just sit in there and do that for these minor league games every game. I think we could do it at home, but on the road would be tough, you know. But I love it, man. I'm going to try to tune you guys in and listen now just to hear how good it is. And one of the reasons that interests me is that I'm an engineer myself, you know, and I taught myself to be an engineer because I thought that it might help me with opportunities. And that started when I was in college at Alabama. You know, we had some really bad broadcast equipment, and there were a lot of times where you would get to the game and the old Marty, which is a type of transmitter that we had back then, wouldn't work. And I mean, this thing was, you had to have this giant antenna, and you had to point it towards the transistor that was on the tower, the radio tower. So you couldn't be too far away because this thing had to hit like a clear shot at the transmitter for you to be able to broadcast. And then it had this the CB truck wire that would run off of that into the booth, you know, and then it would, and then there was this equipment that you'd have, and it was like this giant heavy metal box, and then that thing had to work, and that's how you got on the air, and then you had your headphones and all that stuff, your board would come off of that, right? Well, there were games where, like, you would sign up for a game, you know, when you were, I don't know, it wasn't like you were assigned a game. You'd just sign up when Alabama baseball was playing, and you would get to do the game. And certain guys would sign up, and then they'd never do the game because they couldn't get the equipment to work, you know. So I realized early on that if I learned how to set that equipment up and put it together, that I would be valuable because they would, whoever was doing it would want me to be on the radio with them because they would want to make sure that they got on the air, you know? So then from there, you know, I got into doing minor league baseball, which you do too. And, you know, when I first started out, you know, you use like a phone line, you know, I had like different phone line units. Remote Mix Sport was one that you would just call through a regular, you know, Marlboro phone, or you could hook it up through your cell phone. You know, then we went to, you know, the Comrex stuff, you know, the Matrix. Before that, the Red Box. There was a Blue Box that they had, you know, and now it's these accesses, which are like internet based, you know. But sometimes the internet doesn't work, you know, so I figured out how to do it through my cell phone, you know, if that's as a backup, or the, you know, instead of having a hard line, the wireless. The more of that stuff that you can learn, and then that's not even getting into how to set up your board and your broadcast. The Cubs spring training job started because I could engineer and broadcast, you know. And so, you know, over the years, I've gotten to know Walt Ellis, and anyone that's familiar with engineering and professional sports in Arizona knows who I'm talking about with Walt Ellis, because he does everything. You know, Cardinals football and Suns basketball, and then all these spring training games. And, you know, I think he does a lot of stuff at the Diamondbacks for the road team. You know, Walt's helped me out a lot, you know, a Vietnam vet that knows everything about everything. And the retired and the great Don Free, who was 50 years engineer for the Kansas City Royals. And before he retired, you know, just talking about engineering with him, you know. Tim Berry was a guy in Tennessee that did it for years and years and still does. These guys are like geniuses when it comes to setting up a broadcast and making it sound really good. And I feel like if you turn on a Smokies game, you know, we don't have a guy that can sit back there and you know, ramp up the mics for a pitch. And I'll tell you what, that's something that you got on my mind now. So that may change soon, but everything else, I think that sounds as good as you could possibly get it to. And it's because, you know, like, I've taken engineering as seriously as I do the broadcasting.
That, to my mind, is so important. It's the same thing. If I gave you a book to read and I said, this is a great book, and you look at it and it's misshapen, or there are typos, or if there's anything like that, before we get into the true substance of the quality of the broadcast, everything's got to sound good. Your game notes should be aesthetically pleasing, a uniform, whatever it might be. It's got to look good from the very first impression. And then from after that, then we can see all of those subtle layers of quality. So it's so important to me in tuning into a broadcast, radio, television, that they get all of those things right, the graphics right, the sound levels right, and then I can really sit down and enjoy the broadcast.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I think you're exactly right, too. I mean, like, you know, if you sound, you turn into a game and it sounds like they're broadcasting from a tin can on a string, you know, you're not going to want to sit there and listen to it. I don't care who's doing the game.
Yes. You better have good equipment. You better have good headsets. You bet all those different things. And it's tough because it's expensive. There are all the different complications that arise. But I went to college specifically. My broadcast major was the equipment side, and I struggled. I am not a natural with equipment, but I understand how important it is to get it right.
Yeah, well, you know, have someone fill in for you that doesn't know what they're doing, and then have to try to walk through and explain to them how to set up your equipment. And then you realize like how good you really are at it, you know, when you got to troubleshoot.
Exactly.
And you can do it, you know, over a phone line, you know. Now it's easier now because of, you know, technology. I mean, like, you know, you can with FaceTime, you know, at least you can look at it and say, hey, here, do this, and this, you know. But you probably don't even realize how good you are at it because, you know, like it's just something that you do every day.
See, now I'm self-conscious about how this final quality of the audio is going to turn out because it's the two of us on our telephones. But I'm glad that we got this back and going once again, you and I talking to each other all about broadcasting and baseball as we wind down another show. Mick, any final thoughts?
Well, when we weren't doing the show, I mean, we took a little, what we call in the business, a hiatus. I miss talking to you, man. So it's good to kind of get back here and, you know, and get this thing rolling again. And, you know, hopefully, you know, technology catches up with us as far as being able to do the same show with video again. Because I do like kind of having the your face up there where I can see your expressions and stuff. But you know what? This is good too. It's a lot easier for people to watch and or actually to listen to because, you know, you can be driving or you can be working in the garage or you can be, you know, sitting at the table. So you don't necessarily have to be fixated to, you know, a screen to be able to listen to the show. So, hey, and also let's do it again next week and have a great week.
Yes. You can find Mick Gillespie on Twitter at BroadcasterMick. I'm at Jay Goldstrass, JGOLDSTRASS. This is the Ballpark Digest Broadcaster Chat. Thank you very much for listening.